The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. In this twilight part of the year, between Christmas and New Year, we thought we'd bring you a look through some of the big stories of 2012. So why don't you put another log on that fire, make yourself another turkey sandwich and just settle in. We'll be discussing brand new fundamental particles, the dark matter of the genome, Martian explorers and shrinking Arctic ice. Joining me to mull over 2012 are the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Season's greetings, gents. How was your Christmas? How were your Christmases? Did you spend it together?
I imagine we're just good friends.
Did you have a goose or was it a turducken? What did you have?
It was a goose. Definitely a goose.
Ian?
I was around Robin's house, but I actually hid from him the whole time I was there.
Was that when you were rustling in the hedge? But I was wondering that.
Well, talking of hiding in all sorts of weird places, we found something this year. First up, the biggest and possibly smallest story of 2012. This year we came closer than ever to something that walks like a Higgs boson, talks like a Higgs boson, and sometimes quacks like a Higgs boson as well.
Okay, I think we will begin. So thank you all for coming. Thank you for your patience. It's my pleasure to introduce you to our Director General, Rolf Hoyer, the spokespersons of the two LHC experiments involved in today's announcement, Fabiola Giannotti.
As a layman, I would say we have it. But as a scientist, I have to say, what do we have? We have something, yeah? We have discovered a boson.
That there would always, in this kind of theory, be some leftover spin zero particles which did have mass. And these are what became known as Higgs bosons.
This is what we get. They line up extremely well, and in the region of 125 GeV, they combine to give us a combined significance of 5 standard deviations.
Robin, I'm going to come to you for some explanations about this story. The Higgs boson is almost found. Tell us what's happened in the past year. We had John Butterworth, one of the scientists leading a collaboration, the ATLAS collaboration at CERN. And last year, he was telling us that they'd almost found it. What's the update?
Well, they have found it, really, in all but name. I think it needs a particle consistent with the Higgs boson has been detected. It's been a long time in coming. I think Peter Higgs postulated this in the 60s, and I interviewed him in the 80s. I was the first journalist ever to interview him about this. So that shows you where I came in this one. And it has been that long in the finding, so we've got 50 years.
And you're still here.
And I'm still here, and he's still here. And he's getting the Nobel Prize, and I'm going to get bugger all.
You'll get an ABSW prize. No, listen, so the Higgs mechanism, Ian, you might as well explain this. What is it? Just give us a two-sentence summary of what the Higgs boson is.
So you can only use sort of really rough analogies for this kind of thing, but one way
imagine
of looking
Robin
at it is,
walks into a room.
Yeah, yeah. That, so that, one way, of, way. Of looking. Yeah. I mean,
and all the ladies just kind of
forget for a second the Higgs boson, because that's a little bit of a sort of a sideshow. But what's interesting is the Higgs field, which is this invisible field that sort of permeates the vacuum, is throughout the vacuum of space, and when particles travel through it, some of them interact with this field and gain mass as a result. Things like photons, don't they, carry on at speed of light, but a lot of massive particles, not all of them, get their mass from this interaction with this Higgs field. The Higgs boson is actually just a kind of a smoking gun that tells you the Higgs field is there.
And this year, over various announcements, they've got closer and closer to discovering the existence of this particle and therefore the field. Is it confirmed? I mean, Robin said earlier that it's there, but they haven't actually announced it, have they?
No, they haven't said we have got the Higgs boson. What they've said is we've got a Higgs-like particle, and there are reasons why they're being cautious, and not only because they're very sort of this is the sort of the nature of scientists, and rightly so. But they You don't want to overdo this, though. I mean, it is some kind of Higgs particle, because they searched for it using methods that were designed to look exactly for the kind of signature you would get from a Higgs particle. So it's not as if they were just looking around and they found a particle and said, oh, maybe it's that Higgs. These searches were very well tuned to look for a Higgs particle, and they found a particle. They just need to nail down some of its properties to be absolutely sure that it's not something, you know, highly unlikely, but something possibly that's doing a similar job but isn't a Higgs.
So what's the point of discovering all this stuff, guys?
You now know that there is this field in the vacuum that is doing something. We know something new about how the universe works, about why it's clumpy, why you get galaxies and things like that, why particles have the masses have masses. I mean, this is a hugely important thing to know.
There's two things I'll say just to wind up, which is that with the Higgs mechanism, now that it's pretty much been shown to exist, you do get this idea of particles having masses, although not all the mass in the universe, or not all the mass of particles we know of, is anything to do with the Higgs mass. In fact, can you correct this sort of assumption people have that all particles get their mass from the Higgs mechanism?
Well, as you'll know from reading my very thorough and comprehensive book on the Higgs.
Oh, you've written a book? Oh, shit. Sorry, I'm so embarrassed. Oh.
No, look.
It's a massive book, yeah.
The Higgs field gives you probably about 1% of the mass of you, and like your dog and your cell phone, whatever, or everyday objects.
And the rest?
Even take an atom, about a 1%, 2% comes from the Higgs field. If you pull an atom apart, you will, the mass of like the electrons and the individual quarks inside the protons and neutrons will get their masses from the Higgs field. But when these things join together, so in an atomic nucleus, when you have the quarks, they're bound together by gluons inside the nucleus. It's that energy that is binding those atomic nuclei together, the quarks together inside the atomic nuclei, that gives them their mass. It gives them about 98, 99% of their mass, which is just, so it's basically quark and gluon energy.
And that mass
binding
is,
those, this is a strong force that's mass, holding them together.
And that mass is it's calculable by E equals MC squared, of course.
Why not?
The other thing that I think is interesting about the discovery of the Higgs boson, not only, you know, it's a confirmation of mass and everything, is this is the first attempt we've got to understand the structure of the vacuum. Now, this is something interesting. Ooh. Because the vacuum, you know, is an empty space. And in the Victorian concept of this, is it's nothing. When in fact, quantum mechanics tells us, no, it's not nothing at all. There are particles fizzing in and out of existence all the time. And you can't really probe it very much. And the Higgs mechanism is the first bit that says to you why there is something rather than nothing, perhaps. It's the first window onto all of that. And once you can start to you know, create Higgs bosons on a massive scale, forgive the pun, in the Large Hadron Collider and subsequent particle accelerators, and actually work out all its properties, work out if there are more than one Higgs boson or not, look at all these fundamental laws of physics beyond there, you start to understand the vacuum on a much greater scale, which gets you much closer to the Big Bang and beyond.
Just like that.
Just like that. Just like
that was interesting and informative.
Oh, good. All right, well, let's move on, shall we?
Maybe you should write that book.
No, another. Maybe I should. From quantum particles to the human genome. This year, the Public Research Consortium, dedicated to creating an encyclopedia of DNA elements, known as the ENCODE Project, announced that what we thought was junk DNA is in fact a key part in controlling the 2% of the DNA that creates proteins in the human body.
I do appreciate this from the outside, that people might say, well, wait a second, didn't we sequence the genome in 2000?
That's right. 2000?
Didn't we do this? And that was the starting line. That was the start, not the finish line of this thing. And it's definitely for me a marathon. I remember I was involved in the early analysis of the human genome. And I absolutely remember this feeling that we will be doing this, I think, for this entire century, which is trying to understand how humans work. And like I said, we are one of the most complicated, if not the most complicated machine that we know about is ourselves. And the idea that this was going to be a simple thing to understand is slightly hubris. I find it now difficult. I mean, it's bad enough wrapping your head around C. elegans, which is a small worm with only 600 cells and stuff like that. That's hard enough. A human is just awesome in its complexity. And somehow that complexity is encoded in the genome.
Dr. Ewan Burney there of the European Bioinformatics Institute here in the UK. He was speaking there about the ENCODE announcements, which, the whole interview is available at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. It's an hour long, and you'll get a lot of genetic information in there if you want to go and have a listen. But this is an interesting story for several reasons. when I said in the introduction, it's the end of junk DNA. I mean, scientists have never really called it junk DNA for a while now. There was some assumption back in the 80s and 90s that there was all this stuff outside what we know codes for proteins, 2% codes for proteins, about 98% doesn't seem to be doing very much. And so someone flippantly called it junk. Of course, that story's changed ever since the sequencing of the human genome back in 2000 and 2003. This stuff is clearly doing something, but we don't know what. And we don't know how much of it is doing what. And the ENCODE project was the first real systematic attempt to try and sequence that and to try and annotate what it was all doing. And lo and behold, around 9% was found to be switching the functions of the protein coding genes. And then they think they'll find another 9% or so. So around 20% of the genome. So 10 times the amount that codes for the actual genes themselves is stuff that's switching the proteins or coding genes on and off, regulating their behavior, hugely important in many, many complex diseases. When we think of disease, normally we think of mutations in protein coding genes. But actually, what if the regulation of the genes are at fault? And if you could sort of fix that, that's another drug target. Your thoughts on this? I mean,
not just diseases, I would say, but also understanding the difference, for instance, between human beings and chimpanzees. Everyone goes on about how very, very closely similar we are in terms of genes. But of course, it's the switching of those genes that makes a massive difference between ourselves and a chimpanzee. And this is the first chance we're getting a handle on that and understanding the way that the genes are regulated and explaining the actual nature of being a member of Homo sapiens.
And I mean, the question always was, people used to think there were 100,000 genes in the human genome. When the sequence was announced in 2003, they found 25,000 or so. And the question was, well, how can all this functionality, how can such a complex being such as ourselves, you know, be coded for in such a small number of genes? I mean, there are very simple animals with many more genes. Watercress and lettuce and all sorts of things have similar or more genes, I believe. Is that right?
So, your sandwich has got more genes than you have, Ian Sample. You realise that?
Yeah, this is right. Anyway, obviously there has to be something complicated going on in the non-coding areas. And this is an attempt to understand that, which is that the genome is not this sort of string of DNA that just sits there by itself. It's a functioning 3D molecule that is always working. It's attaching itself to bits of the genome attached to other bits, and when the coding's happening, the amounts of proteins being made are controlled, as I said, by all these switches. So it's a fully functioning 3D thing going through time, and I think that's an interesting thing to try and understand. It's the next phase of molecular biology. Ewan Burney, who we heard from, leading one of the teams behind the ENCODE project, said to me that it was going to be a century's work to try and understand the genome. That's how complicated it is. So there's at least a century's worth of work there, which is probably good news for geneticists. In 2012, there was plenty of good news in science, but there's also some bad news. Satellite imaging and on-the-ground measurements have revealed that sea ice in the Arctic shrunk to the smallest extent ever recorded. During summer, the ice coverage here is now almost half of what it was four decades ago. Robin, tell us what the patterns of ice coverage are like in the Arctic these days.
Well, pretty sketchy when it comes to summer. It's not just the fact that the extent of the sea ice that's going away, but it's quite clear from satellite measurements from Cryosat-2 and from also using measurements taken from submarines, that ice is getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and that the prospect of very soon we have a completely ice-free summer in the Arctic is raising its head.
That's been predicted for a while, isn't it? I mean, people have been sort of revising their estimates on
bringing
this.
It forward, though. I mean, and saying it's there's several interesting things to say about that. We were discussing earlier about the Higgs boson and the discovery of that, and people think that's the biggest experiment that basically we've ever carried out, but it's not. The experiment we're carrying out on our planet is the biggest experiment that mankind has ever carried out, and this is a perfect example of what the results of that experiment are. They are very, very worrying. Scientists predicted that sea ice would shrink in summer, but not at the rate it's going. It's going much faster. It's disappearing at a far more alarming rate than people were expecting. Now, when David Attenborough eventually said something about this about a year ago, about the state of Arctic sea ice. He was picked on by climate change deniers such as Nigel Lawson, who said, oh yes, but he forgot to mention that Antarctic sea ice is increasing. Well, it comes close to some of the biggest porkies you've ever heard, because Antarctic sea ice has gone up like a tiny, tiny fraction, and Arctic sea ice is disappearing. And the difference is at least tenfold, showing exactly why. And why is this happening? Because the world's heating up, and because we're creating this incredible experiment, pumping all this crap into the air.
The Antarctic's not doing actually great in all of it, over all parts of it. I mean, some parts are, the ice is thickening, but there are ice shelves calving all the time, icebergs floating off and not refreezing back into the main continent.
In fact, it's within the slight increase in Antarctic ice is just within sort of normal, statistical flow, really.
I mean, people talk about tipping points, and I don't want to sort of alarm anything here, but, at some point, if all the sea ice in the Arctic melts, I mean, is that one of our tipping points to sort of catastrophic climate change that people have been warning about for a long time?
I would have thought so. I mean, I think we may have passed that tipping point in that particular case, because the amount of dark sea water, the ice disappears, less heat is reflected back into space, and more is absorbed by the oceans, which are dark. I think there's enough ice disappearing now in summer for us to imagine that tipping point has been achieved.
Ian?
Well, I suppose the only thing I was going to say was that with the Arctic ice, I mean, one thing that doesn't give you is any change in sea levels, obviously, because it's sea ice. It's just ice floating on the water, so you can melt in. It won't actually change your sea levels. Say it's not a serious problem, but I know sometimes these things get put out as being misunderstood. I mean, if that happens in the South Pole, obviously, when you're losing ice off the land, then that's a problem when it comes to sea rises.
But equally, that sea ice supports all the ice that stands on Greenland, and when it goes, it's the supporting ice that's holding some of the Greenland ice cap goes. And again, research is showing that Greenland ice cap is melting at a faster rate.
The other point about the ice, Arctic sea ice disappearing, is that it opens up new trade routes and mining opportunities of oil, which is just going to make the situation even worse.
Yes, and more and more ability to go in there and fish one of the last, probably the last great marine reserves on the planet.
UHF is good.
From the big blue planet to a slightly smaller red planet. There were whoops of joy at NASA in August as the Curiosity rover landed on Mars in a breathtakingly complicated touchdown. Ian, this is surely the most cinematic of 2012's scientific events, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it was totally out of the movies the way they landed this probe on Mars. I mean, it was just...
It's worth rehearsing again. What did they do?
I can still not believe what they did. I mean, this probe is on the way to Mars. It's coming in around 8,000 miles an hour, and then it does a whole run of things. One of the things I found actually most lovely about how they do it, it's called the EDL, the entry, descent, and landing part, is it you end up with a sort of spaceship-shaped sort of part coming in, and it sheds weights. It fires weights off itself as it hits the atmosphere, which enables it to fly through the thin atmosphere, which it wasn't obviously in space. It's just going through vacuum, comes into the atmosphere, sheds weights. So it tilts the axis of it, changes the center of gravity, allows it to actually fly through the Martian atmosphere towards its landing place. And it's got onboard computers and sensors, which it's constantly judging its trajectory, judging where it's going to go, and is making changes to its aerodynamics and flying autonomously through the Martian atmosphere. Okay, that's, I think, pretty cool stuff when you're talking about the speeds at which it's going at, the distance it's going at. There's nothing you can do from Earth. It's too far away for you to do real-time control on this thing. It takes 20 minutes for a radio signal to get there. But then the whole system comes to a over the landing site, fires retro rockets. It doesn't hover, but it's on the way down. But as this thing starts going towards the Martian ground, it then lowers out on nylon ropes the rover from beneath. So it's winching it down onto the surface. And when the rover hits the Martian surface, the sky crane bit, the bit above it, which is still coming down on these retro rockets, flies off and crashes a good distance away to kind of keep any contamination away. And from there on, your rover is down. And the whole thing takes 7 minutes. They called it famously the 7 minutes of terror. It was the most audacious landing on a foreign, on an alien world ever attempted. And it went utterly perfectly. And you just thought, you look at what they do and you thought, I can't believe this is going
to
work.
Yeah, well, if this was in a movie, you'd think this is just a bit of Hollywood license, wouldn't you?
Completely. Yeah, it was so brazen, but it worked fantastically.
And the rover has been sort of stretching its legs and calibrating in the last few months, and found already got some amazingly interesting results, Robin. Well, it's proving to be a brilliant machine.
It's absolutely perfect. I think the last thing I noticed was that it seems to be sort of resting on a bed of clay at the moment, and could I get that kind of level of knowledge about the Martian surface? It's just extraordinary. And, you know, we've got another 2 years of it. It's not designed to find life, which is a shame, but it's designed to find if conditions are conducive to life on Mars. And I think it's just, you know, the most wonderful machine that was created last year.
At the beginning of December, there was some internet rumor that it was going to announce, that NASA was going to announce something special. In the end, it found complex molecules. Ian, tell us a bit about what that particular result was.
So the fuss, the big sort of media hoo-ha around this was because John Grotzinger, the project scientist, said to an NPR reporter that the results coming out of the machine were going to be earth-shaking. And that got interpreted and misinterpreted as being as NASA essentially finding life or something close to it, which was a leap that only the media would probably make. And it turned out that what they had was, from a more sort of sober standpoint, it was really interesting. They had, they found what looks to be perchlorates, which is a chemical which was also discovered by a previous NASA lander called Phoenix. Now, that's interesting because some microbes in the Atacama Desert in Chile use that as an energy source. Another sort of flip side of it, it actually can destroy organics. So there's a kind of a double-edged sword with that one, whether it's good news or bad news. But they also found evidence for simple organic molecules. Now, that can be exciting because those can be building blocks for life, but they can also be, and what may be the case in this instance, which is still being checked out, those organics may simply be compounds that form with carbon that was carried up as contamination on the rover. It's not yet known. It may also be carbon that's or compounds that have come down in meteorites that rain down on Mars, because basically these compounds were found by taking a scoop of soil and heating up in the onboard ovens, and you get these organics coming off.
And once again, Robin, just rehearse for us what we can look forward to in the next decade or so of Mars exploration, because NASA and the European Space Agency seem to be very excited about the planet getting rovers over there.
Yes, Europe has got its project 2017-2018, the ExoMars, which is going with the Russians, and basically the Americans have said they're going to have another Curiosity in about 8 years, which will probably be more directed to looking for living life forms, I should say, than this one is.
So
I should tell you, I have very good information that Curiosity found a watch with a Nazi swastika on it, but the CIA have suppressed it. Ari, you heard this first, you know.
We were keeping the surprises to the end, Robin, but you've just
ruined it.
ruined that.
I just wanted to say something, sort of paint a little picture about where Curiosity is, just to give people an idea of what it's going to be doing on its mission out there. And what they did is they came down quite near the bottom of what's called an alluvial fan, which is one of these amazing sort of structures you see in the sort of the soil, if you like, where ancient water's flown. So you see, you can imagine what it looks like. It was just an old riverbed, if you like, just rubble that's been transported along. And so you know you've landed at a point where there has previously been some water flow. So you can look around to see what you can find there. Can you find any evidence that environment once had standing water that might have been useful for life, because any sort of very temporary water may not have been very useful. But then the rover is going to trundle over to this enormous mountain in the center of this crater. So
Mount Sharp.
The probe landed in Gale Crater. Mount Sharp in the middle of that crater rises 5 kilometers above the base of the crater. It's a 5-kilometer high mountain. And at the base, the This is a sedimentary rock, and at the base of it, this rock is probably about 3.5 billion years old. So you can start, because it's exposed, you can start analyzing that rock and looking at what the conditions were, the environmental conditions were back then. And obviously, the lovely thing is what they've done is they've got so many observing satellites around Mars that they've been able to map the heck out of the mountain, plot a route that the rover can go up, up to the top of the mountain. And as it can go up, it can take sample rock on the way up. And obviously, as you get higher and higher and higher, that rock gets younger and younger and younger. So you go from 3.5 billion years ago to more modern times, and you get, you know, in that one mountain, you can get a pretty good record of the Martian history for that location. And I think that's just fantastic stuff.
So this mission is clearly pushing all the limits of space technology and the heroics. And how much has it all cost?
It was $2.5 billion, that mission,
which seems like nothing in our times of, you know, $1 trillion bailouts and things. It just seems like nothing. I know that for you, as a laird in Scotland, Robin, $2.5 billion is nothing. As well,
absolutely nothing.
Your golf courses and things. But seriously, exactly. it's actually not that much, is it?
Well, it's value for money. That's what I would say.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of knowledge, not only that, but also the technology that's being produced. More of those, please. Yes, NASA. Well done. We're going to move to molecular biology now for a controversial piece of research that was carried out by two teams of scientists, one in the US and the other in the Netherlands, looking at what makes the H5N1 bird flu virus dangerous. Indeed, what could make it infectious between humans? In March, scientists created a mutant form of the virus that could transmit between people, something the virus can't do in real life. And that led to questions. Should the work be published? Who should control that information? Ian, this was probably one of the most controversial and most interesting stories in 2012.
Yeah.
And just explain what actually happened before we go into the ethics of it all.
So this was undoubtedly the biggest controversy in science this year, the biggest controversy in science for a long time, as far as I can remember. And what happened was Ron Fouché at Erasmus Medical Center in the Netherlands and another researcher out in Wisconsin, Madison, they both produced did research and wrote papers up where they had mutated the H5N1 bird flu virus in different ways, but they've mutated them to show that they transmit, with these mutations, they transmitted very easily between ferrets. And ferrets are the animal of choice to check how a virus will spread between humans through coughs and sneezes. Now, H5N1 bird flu, as the name suggests, mostly wipes out birds, but it's killed, when it gets into humans, it's killed half of humans who've got it. It's incredibly pathogenic. So one of the big fears is that somewhere in nature, a reassortment is going to happen, mutations are going to happen, that these viruses are going to evolve to a point where they are highly transmissible among humans. And these guys produced those viruses, essentially, that would make them highly transmissible. Now, what happened that made this so controversial then was that the US biosecurity panel stepped in and said, you shouldn't publish this work. It's too dangerous because it might get into the wrong hands, i.e. some sort of rogue nation or terrorist who may want to use this for nefarious means.
And at first, that sounds eminently sensible. The idea that you wouldn't transmit the information about something so dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there must be a line somewhere, I think, where someone can do some research in a lab and it can be deemed too dangerous to publish. I think there are experiments you can think of or results that you might stumble across by accident, more likely, where you say, hold on, this is probably not a great thing to publish. But you have to think about, with flu research, we have people all around the world, and especially in the nations where these viruses tend to emerge, Southeast Asia and places like that, where people live very closely among the poultry and things like that. There are researchers out there doing surveillance on the front line who really need this information. They are doing genetic tests on strains that crop up. They need to be able to see when a virus is getting to the point where it's going to become dangerous.
And this is what this research could be useful for. So the guys mutated these viruses to make them more transmissible between ferrets, which are the analogs of people in these experiments. And so if you then know the mutations that would do that, you can look for them in genetic screens in the wild.
And that's right.
You have more time to prepare for them.
That's right. So what this blocking this research would essentially say, okay, there are a couple of labs who've done this work. They know that if you do these certain mutations to this virus, this could go like wildfire around people, you would expect that it may not be so pathogenic if it did that. It may not be quite so lethal. But nonetheless, it would go around and it would be almost certainly utterly devastating. Are you then going to say to the people at the front lines, you're doing genetic testing for these things, we're not going to tell you what genes to look out for, or even the types of genes to look out for, because it may not be these particular mutations that happen in the wild that become dangerous, but you want to know the kinds of things that make the changes, the results of those changes. What is it that makes this virus suddenly go airborne, become very transmissible between people? And that argument essentially won the day, because these papers did end up being published, although, to be fair, in a somewhat revised version.
Robin, there's another question, of course, which is scientific freedom. I mean, the whole point of scientific inquiry is that you find something out and you get it peer-reviewed, you put it out there for people to criticise, and then do things with it. I mean, knowledge is not something which you can just compartmentalise and stick away somewhere.
No. I think the American security people being slightly naive, talking about restricting the number of scientists who would be given access to this information. But so one scientist gets the information, what's he going to do? Not tell these three co-workers who aren't on this list? I mean, it was just completely impractical.
Postdocs, PhD students.
Yeah,
they
have to know what's going on. So it was a completely impractical idea. I think that's really why it didn't win through.
But Ian raises an important point at the beginning, where he said that there are going to be limits at some point. So perhaps governments and security agencies and others should have a much more thought through protocol of how you deal with dual use research. This idea that of a research which can be used for good or ill, whether you want it or not, it's going to happen out there. So there's got to be a better, more structured way of dealing with this stuff.
I don't know. The trouble is, we don't know how much of that work is
certainly
going on.
Certainly,
can you think
it
of an example that shouldn't have gone out that has gone out? I can't off the top of my head.
Well, there are still people on this security panel who believe that this research shouldn't have been published. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't unanimous from that panel that, okay, we were wrong, go ahead and publish it. I think there are still serious concerns, but it was essentially too late. The whole thing was a fiasco. Now, the US is still, at the moment, working on guidelines that may require certain researchers doing certain work to have their work put through what they call like a special review to determine whether it can be published or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people, scientists, are going to have a problem with that, again, because, you know, science is essentially and fundamentally an open process that you need. The point of science is to find stuff out and to make it everyone, you know, give it to everybody else.
Yeah.
But, you know, there aren't, this can be done in other ways. I mean, the military does a heck of a lot of research that it's quite happily keeps to itself. I think you need to just maybe adopt some of those.
That's much more technological, though, isn't it, rather than fundamental science?
Well, not if you look at places like Porton Down and so on, when they were working on, you know, methods for dealing with.
This is the Ministry of Defence
Lab. Sorry, this is a minister. Yeah, well, this was a UK defence lab that was looking at things like how do you deal with exposure to chemical weapons, to nerve agents, and things like that. There's a lot of very sort of basic sort of, you know, work going on that sort of thing, which is clearly classified. And some of this flu stuff, some of this biotechnology is getting very much into that area now.
Okay, well, we'll leave all that there. Before you go, just let's ask, just have a couple of roundup questions about 2012. Was 2012 a good year for science? You know, good news, bad news, whatever, but, you know, for pushing back the frontiers, was it good?
Undoubtedly, for me, I thought there was, and we haven't even mentioned, you know, things like sort of new species of human or new subspecies of human and things like that. It was a cracking year, I think.
The Higgs and Curiosity, too, absolutely, you know, fantastic developments. So, yes, yeah, definitely a good year for science.
After last year's neutrino stuff.
Oh, yes, exactly.
You know, that was the exciting. Physics is definitely the one on the up, I think.
Yeah.
All of these things. But can I also get some predictions from you about next year? Who wants to go first? What stories should our listeners be looking out for? Ian?
I'm really interested in what's going to happen in January when the first big clinical trial looking at using a technique called genome editing to try and essentially cure HIV is due to wrap up. Now, this is like just a fascinating technique where you can take people's immune cells out of them, modify them using a genome editing technique by putting in a gene that confers natural resistance on people at the moment. You put those cells back into people with HIV and you see if that makes them essentially immune to that virus.
Why is that different to gene therapy, the sort of normal stuff we've been hearing about for years, which hasn't really come to fruition.
It's a form of gene therapy, but it's what's nice about it is it has a real elegance in that you can make a single letter change in a genome, but what's more interesting, you can take a gene, replace it with another one, which is the case in this clinical trial going on in the US. And what you don't have to do is worry about the sort of how that gene's expressed in the body, because you're changing, you're taking one gene out and putting another one in, and all the regulatory stuff around it, like you were talking about earlier, all the controls and switches and everything, you don't have to change. Whereas with gene therapy at the moment, as old style gene therapy, you essentially parachute a gene in and you have it lurking in the cell, or you parachute it randomly somewhere into the genome and hope that it works. And it works to some extent, but you know, you have to try and take in the promoters and other kinds of switches and things with it, and it doesn't seem to work so well. So this seems to me to be a sort of a next generation of gene therapy, which looks very promising. It may all go wrong, but it looks very promising.
Sounds to me like the ENCODE stuff's going to be very useful for that. You were shaking your head earlier, just in mock boredom at that. Robin?
I just keep watching the Arctic sea ice, as far as I'm concerned.
It's going.
It's going. Is it going to go again? Is it going to drop below this year, record low?
Well, it will, won't it? I mean, let's be honest. Even if we stop all carbon emissions now, the latency in the atmosphere means that the temperatures will still rise for a couple of years at least.
Yes. Oh, yes, even if you stop. No, certainly not going to do that.
All right. Well, we'll on that note, remember that all the stories we've talked about here are just a click away at guardian.co.uk/science. We're going to post links to them all on the Science Weekly blog as well. We'll be back in January, but from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, we wish you a very happy festive season. And we also want to thank you for listening to the podcast throughout 2012, for commenting on our blog, retweeting us, and generally spurring us on. Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.